Welcome to Pzena Perspectives, brought to you by Pzena Investment Management, a global value manager known for our commitment to fundamental research and disciplined value investing. This podcast is presented by Pzena Investment Management, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor, and is intended for institutional investors only. The views expressed reflect the current views of Pzena as of the date hereof and are subject to change. There is no guarantee that any projection, forecast, or opinion in this material will be realized. Past performance is not indicative of future results. In the UK, this podcast is for professional clients only. This marketing communication is presented by Pzena Investment Management Limited, which is an appointed representative of Vittoria & Partners LLP. Vittoria & Partners LLP is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. On today's episode, our Director of National Accounts, Peter Quinn, speaks with Portfolio Manager and Co-Chief Investment Officer John Goetz about the current opportunity in non-U.S. equities. For additional context on the data presented, don't miss our written piece, Why Invest Outside the U.S., available at www.pzena.com.
Welcome to the latest edition of Pzena Perspectives. We appreciate you taking the time to listen to our podcast. My name is Peter Quinn, Director, Intermediary Distribution, and in this edition, we will discuss the opportunity in investing outside the United States, and I am pleased to be joined by my colleague, John Goetz. John is one of the co-founders of the firm, co-chief investment officer, and portfolio manager on many of our non-U.S. strategies, so the next 30 minutes or so should prove to be very interesting. Before we get to the heart of the conversation, a brief introduction to Pzena Investment Management, in that we are in our 29th year, manage $70 billion as of the end of August, and are known for our commitment to classic value investing. So John, it's been more than 15 years since the last cycle where non-U.S. stocks significantly outperform in a meaningful way, and investors have started to wonder why they should ever invest outside the United States. What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, I'd say they're totally right. It's been really good in the United States. In fact, it's been really almost a historic run of excess performance. It's lasted 15 years. The cumulative effect of that is almost 300% outperformance. The last time we saw something that big in a cumulative run for a geography was actually Japan in the late 1980s, when the optimism there was extreme, I'll just say. It ended poorly, but the optimism was extreme, which was basically the Japanese companies were going to dominate the globe, both because of a cost of capital advantage as well as a technical advantage and excellence in most of the businesses. So those of us that have been around a long time have seen a number of these massive waves. Probably the most recent that was pretty impactful for us was early in our development. China had a real run in our emerging markets product. I remember investors challenging us multiple times during that 2004 to 2008 period, saying, why are you underweight China in emerging markets? And obviously our answer was, because of how we operate, it's all about valuation. So that's where I'm going to start this point, because the way we look at this situation is, what are valuations? What should we believe about the valuation opportunity going forward, not in the rear view mirror? So I think what I would say to an investor challenging is, yeah, that's great, but it's been driven primarily by the Magnificent Seven. And anytime you get that degree of concentration in a small set of stocks, history has not proven that to be that great in an outcome. Again, we're not saying you should go out and short these stocks. What we're saying is you have captured a lot of it in the current valuations. So right now, the thesis in the U.S. is that the U.S. is leading. In fact, that run has been so big that now, you know, we're at the level where if you look at total market cap of developed markets, the U.S. in these indices is in that 65 to 70% range. The last time that happened was when Japan had that degree of concentration in global market cap. So I think it's an interesting time to look at Europe when pessimism is high in Europe. Pessimism is decently high in China. Pessimism is also reasonably high in Japan. So pessimism is much more rampant outside the United States than it is inside the United States today. And we think that's what sets up an interesting opportunity to rifle shoot and pick some really undervalued, excellent companies that the future is not reflected in the current share price.
So, you know, that makes a lot of sense. So essentially what you're saying, John, is that this disparity over the last decade and a half is really coming from unusually strong performance here in the United States. However, what would then be the case for investing in, say, European or Asian stocks?
Yeah, the key thing is what is the story behind the performance, whether it's a stock or a geography. And in this case, the positive story is that certain elements of the U.S. economy are just outperforming and will continue to outperform. We've written about this in a couple of pieces about what happens when the market is very concentrated. In this case, we're talking about the Magnificent Seven being extremely high performing. So again, I just want to differentiate. It isn't so much that the U.S. has been outperforming economically, it's that it's been outperforming from a sentiment standpoint. And I think that's the interesting point to get into, because the reality is that if you look at earnings and earnings performance, the U.S. actually isn't outperforming that much versus outside the United States. It's actually in the multiples. And I'll come back to that in a little bit.
So is there an argument to be made then that ACWI ex-U.S. should trade at such a deep discount and that U.S. companies should have outperformed by such a great magnitude to this point?
Yeah. So let me just give you a little bit of the math there. The reality is that over the last period here, the 15 years we're talking about where the U.S. has outperformed, if you looked at the U.S. added about $1.3 trillion in earnings. Europe and Asia had about $1.6. So actually, if you looked at it in terms of just growth, and remember, the population outside the United States is much bigger than the United States. There are many, many more companies outside the United States than there are inside the United States. So it makes sense maybe that the cumulative generation of earnings would be bigger outside the United States than inside the United States. So that kind of makes sense that Asia added more in earnings. What's interesting is that during this period, the U.S. added $45 trillion in market cap, and Europe and Asia added $28. So, you know, about half the amount of value add. So the reality is that what's happened here is multiples have expanded. And that's where it gets really, really interesting.
So why don't we use this then as an opportunity to drill down on the opportunity set in the U.S. and non-U.S. markets?
If you looked at the valuations, I wanted to come back to just what are we paying for forward earnings in the U.S. and outside the U.S. So roughly, we're paying about 22 times forward earnings in the U.S. And if you look outside the United States, it's in that 14-15 range. Now, then people say, well, you know, is that great a deal? Well, actually, we would agree, too, that we want to pay less for earnings than the market does in general. So when we look at the ex-U.S. value segment, we're down at the 10 times forward earnings level. I think what's interesting about when you say you're paying 10 times earnings in a long-term context, if you flip that around, it means your earnings yield is 10%. That means without any growth, you'd be basically making 10% on your investment. 10% is not so bad. In fact, consultants in the investment committees I've been involved in, consultants are saying you should expect 6 to 7 from equity markets. So I'm just pointing out here that the math says that if you're involved in value outside the United States, your expected return, you know, is logically higher than 6 to 7. So I just wanted to throw that into the mix. When you look at the and I made a price to earnings point, but if you look at the U.S. cheapest quintile, that's also much cheaper than the market. Again, we're going back to this Mag 7 effect, where the big run-up in U.S. multiples is driven by a very, very concentrated set of stocks.
So this might be a good time to put on your active portfolio manager hat. Maybe talk through a couple of the investment ideas or the investment cases in a couple of different names.
We are excited by the investment cases outside the United States, and everyone is pretty much acknowledged. Again, if you talk to investment committees around the world, most people think the U.S. is slightly more efficient than, say, emerging markets or international developed markets. So there generally is a little bit more alpha opportunity. That's been backed up by some studies. But at the end of the day for us, it's not about, you know, is Europe 10 times forward earnings, but it's can we do a good job with some rifle shots into some very, very specific companies. Just going back to the story point, Peter, I mentioned earlier, the reality is if the U.S. is trading at a high multiple, it's because there's optimism about the future. If Europe's trading at a low multiple and the stocks we're looking at trading at a low multiple, there's a negative vibe. There's a pessimistic orientation. And it's that pessimism that we're trying to take advantage of in these portfolios. So let me just give you two examples of pessimism. I'll just put it out there. If I told you that you were going to invest in a stock that's domiciled in France, I think the first reaction would be, what? You know, you're investing in France. I often get these questions. If you then flipped it around and said, no, I'm actually investing in a global leading company that has an incredibly strong brand, evidenced by its ability to introduce new products at a premium price and has consistently done so, with the majority of their profits coming from United States and Asia, you would say, oh, that sounds cool. That company's called Michelin Tire. And whenever I get the question, well, isn't it French? I go, well, actually, they don't make much money in France. And that's a direct quote of a former CEO of Michelin. So there's an example of a company that carries a cyclical weight. It's connected to auto. It's French domiciled. And people don't even want to hear about how it's kind of beating up on the competition by selling premium tires at higher prices than competition because the tires are actually better. So that just gives you one example of the sentiment that's heavy on Europe, enabling us to underpay for future earnings power and cash flow. I did want to add that, Peter, because, you know, when we look at a current multiple, that isn't what we're really doing. We're looking out into the future and saying, is this business better positioned or not?
Well, I think we might have time for one more. Maybe, John, you can kind of illustrate a non-US stock really out of favor, a lot of controversy around it that we currently hold in the portfolio.
Yeah, you said the right word, controversy. So I alluded to earlier that one of the non-US or outside the US outperformance periods was driven by China from 04 all the way to 08. I think that's interesting because, you know, we lived through that period. In fact, in our emerging markets, we were often underweight China. And people would say, why are you underweight China? You know, China's the place to be. And to us, it doesn't seem that long ago, 2004 to 2008. Never mind the fact that I mentioned Japan back in the late 80s. So when you look at these things from a historical context, you see that sentiment swings quite a bit. So this whole preamble was to explain that maybe there are opportunities in China, so that's where I'm going to go. The reality is we've taken quite a significant position in COLI, Chinese overseas land. It's a leading developer, property developer in China. China real estate has been in a tough spot. I often get asked, is it bottoming out? Are price declines ending? Is the overcapacity ending? We don't really see that yet in the data, but what we will say is that the longer this pain goes on, the better COLI might be positioned because these spectacular collapses in the property development like Evergrande really are shrinking the field of capable competitors. That and the fact that they have a cost of capital advantage versus their competitors says maybe the longer this pain goes on, the better position they are. So here we have a situation where we're able to buy what might be, you know, the ultimate winner in this whole crisis at incredibly low valuations.
You know, that brings up a good point, John. Quite often when we're talking with clients and prospects, they ask about state-owned enterprises. Can you maybe illustrate a bit on SOEs, how we view them in the approach that we take?
Yeah, it's really a good point. You know, when you think about the framework of our integrated ESG principles that are integrated in our investing, one of the big ones is G. G stands for governance. When we're looking at a company, particularly outside the United States, maybe, and particularly in China, what we're looking for is, are the governance principles lined up with what we need? Are the incentives lined up? And believe it or not, some of the SOE position businesses, I used to call them government infested instead of government invested when I worked in China. But, you know, the reality is that sometimes it's an advantage. In this case, for COLI, what the advantage is because of the stability and the good balance sheet that COLI has, that actually gives them that cost of funds advantage versus some of the more, what I'll call, unconnected enterprises. And we've seen no evidence that the government is in any way harming, other than conservatism, which was helpful during this crazy boom, that conservatism built a better balance sheet. So you could say that the government effect was actually positive during this period. Now, the overarching question in China is, oh, what about the political risk of investing in China, period? That's a whole nother subject, not the subject for this little talk. I'll just say that, you know, at the end of the day, we build very diversified portfolios, whether it's political risk or economic risk. So we think we have this in the right context. But this is a case where being cooperative with the government probably is a long-term asset.
So, John, essentially what you're saying in summary is that there still remains opportunity outside the U.S. The differential in return of non-U.S. versus U.S. investing was really driven by a strong U.S. market, and the diversification aspects of non-U.S. investing still remain very attractive.
Right. I like to remind people we don't actually know the future, but I think that our case for many of the companies in our non-U.S. portfolios growing earnings into the future is a very good case. We're not paying for growth in earnings virtually anywhere outside the United States right now. So I think the question that comes down to us from a valuation and investor standpoint is, are the multiples in the United States, particularly for the Magnificent Seven, justified by future earnings growth? We're not going to attack those companies. We're not in the business of shorting the Mag 7. We just know that the expectations are high because you're trading at such a high multiple already that we'd rather hang out where we're paying a really low multiple for what we expect to have happen in the future. And there's a lot of those opportunities outside the United States.
That's great. So with that, we'll wrap it up. But on behalf of John and all my colleagues at Pzena Investment Management, we would like to thank you for taking the time to listen to this edition of Pzena Perspectives. As always, if there's anything that we can do for you, or if you have any follow-up questions, please reach out to us at info@pzena.com.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Pzena Perspectives. If you'd like to hear more, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. And for more insights on value investing, visit our website at www.pzena.com. That's www.pzena.com.